This is part two of episode 541 of Unwelcome Guests, Out in Prison. The talk is by Assistant Professor Vivian Salehanna.
At the same time, criminology and criminal justice, much like the institution of prison, is segregated from all the other disciplines that surround it. And because they create these disciplines that are supposed to exist in isolation from each other, they are able to conquer knowledge. And so what I started to do was to desegregate knowledge by bringing in archaeology, history, different types of science, literature, ethnomusicology. And right now, you're going to hear about this because it's the thing that I'm most interested in for the past year, is rewriting a timeline which would help us see the larger picture of history. And this timeline is inspired by my research on music because my dissertation committee asked me to write a chapter on Black history. And quickly through the lyrics, I began to understand that Black history has become a dumping ground for all of the bad things that white people have done. So slavery, apartheid, colonialism, Jim Crow. All of these things being acts committed by Europeans and colonists who are from Europe, yet we classify them as Black history. And that's problematic, not just because it's degrading, but also because they've erased Black history, because they've replaced Black history with this concept of white supremacist Black history. So I had to reject this notion of Black history and to begin to rebuild what I think Black history is, and that would include studying and documenting events and acts that were done by Black people. So it took me all the way back to 2650 BC, which is the first documented voyages from Africa to the United States. A Black Egyptian pharaoh named Sneferu built 63 ships that measured 100 to 179 feet each, and he sailed across the Atlantic, and archaeological evidence does support this fact. A European scholar named Bailey in 1973 decided to test this theory to make sure that it wasn't true. His hypothesis was that this is not possible, so he actually rebuilt the ships in 1973 and expected them to sink, and they actually sailed all the way across the Atlantic. So 2650 BC. For hundreds of years, African scholars have been talking about these voyages, and that being Black history, and the fact that the world has never existed in isolation. Because the European version of history is that these continents exist in isolation from each other, and then Europeans traveled in the 1400s and desegregated the world, which is the opposite of a world existing together. Let's not romanticize it. Some good, some bad, but most of the interactions did not result in genocide. Right? So the world existing back and forth, interacting, and becoming segregated through European colonialism. So 2650 BC. 800 BC, there are African terracotta stoneheads in Mexico and Central America. And if you start to interrogate what they mean by Mexico, that also includes the United States, because that boundary between Mexico and the U.S. is very new. 300 BC, you have a redrawn revision of a map, and it is a map of the world. It was discovered by a man named Piriri. He was a Turkish explorer. And on this map, which is a redrawn revision of the world, you have the Mid-Atlantic Islands, Cape Verde, Madeira Islands, the Azores, in perfect longitude. You have the Canary Islands, only off by 1 degree. You have the Andes, the Erato River in Colombia, the Amazon River. And even more remarkable is the near accuracy of the longitudinal and latitudinal coordinates between Africa and the Americas. And so when you go into just a very basic, and this is just scratching the level of archaeology, into a very basic research of what history looks like, it's not hard to find these documented, even European documented, existence of people traveling. 1250 AD, you have the Mandingo traders, because often white supremacy will teach us that Egypt is not a part of Africa, which it is, and I attest to that because I am from Egypt and I'm African. But there's also sub-Saharan Africa. The Mandingo travelers from what is now called Mali traveled in 1250 BC, and again in 1250 AD, and then again in 1311 AD, and these ships that traveled actually stayed. So about 2,000 ships traveled across the Atlantic about 100 years before Columbus. And so when Columbus arrived in what is now called the United States, it was actually a very multicultural society. And there was as many people here as there are on Africa, on the African continent today. And so the images that we are given of these continents on this side of the Atlantic are also very segregated, monolithic, and so-called uncivilized. So there was actually hundreds of thousands of Black people already existing and living here in the United States. In 1991, the U.S. government gave back some of the land they took from the black folks that were here already. So all of that being said, the First World War began, in my opinion, when these ships, from the European ships, traveled across the ocean with slaves inside them. And that war has continued for 400 years, up until the first defined European World War in 1914. When Europeans began to die, they defined that as a war. So the first prisons, according to European history, were built in the 1700s. This is simply not true. When I was living in West Africa, I saw the slave dungeons. I saw that the slave dungeons actually became prisons, physically as buildings, when the British arrived and colonized Ghana. And so the first prisons were not built in the 1700s. They were built in the 1400s. In terms of what that looks like in the United States, those prisons existed on plantations, right? Those prisons existed on slave ships. So the architecture of punishment is something that has been strategized, created by scientists, physicians, archaeologists, and so on and so forth, right? And so what you have to understand is that when we talk about the prison today, it comes out of this history of 500 years of segregation and violence, and at the root of all that is a racialized violence that we have to understand. And so in order for us to talk about prisons, we must talk about white supremacy, and we must understand white supremacy as a form of war. And in order to dismantle what we now call the prison industrial complex, we must dismantle white supremacy. And we must begin to learn to see the world as it exists, with all of its violence, but also all of its beauty, and to desegregate our understandings of this world. And I think one of the biggest issues that we face today is the segregated experiences people have in communities and in societies. So the black community's experience with the prison is radically different from the white community, the immigrant community, right? The middle class, the lower class, the gendered, the age. So all of these things exist in isolation, and I think that at the root of that is our view of the world. Because on some level, if we believe that the continents were segregated prior to European travels, then we also believe that segregation is something that is natural and that we have to fight against to desegregate, as opposed to understanding that segregation is unnatural and we have to fight against that as an unnatural thing that separates us from each other. And so at the root of this violence is this notion of segregation, which rears its head through these laws that are clearly segregationist. But we have to see it beyond these laws and begin to understand the foundations of that. And until we dismantle those foundations, we will always come up against specific laws or institutions that legalize segregation.
Interesting that Salihana also talks about the prison industrial complex, as did our first speaker, Sasha Abramsky. And I think her analysis gets closer to the root of the problem, which is that of separation, which is, of course, a familiar theme on this show. The idea that people are, in fact, a unity, but that our way of understanding the world and our legal and other systems treat humanity's separate parts as divisible beings. Why are there thousands of Americans in prison for possession of marijuana for a longer time than Hitler's collaborators were locked up by the Nuremberg war crimes? Why do people accept this? Only because of dumbing down. Why is it happening? It's making money for certain people. It's keeping other people off the streets. It's masking the inequality. It's doing many, many things. All the injustices are interlinked. And as we desegregate our understandings, as we follow the connections, we find how the system relies on people taking short-term, selfish attitudes, people following their programming to deny the love that is inside them for life, for their fellow man, and for the truth. So for this reason, if for no other, desegregating our understanding of the world, and as we shall hear at the very end, desegregating our moral concerns should be high on our agendas, I think. That is, to understand the connectedness of everything and everyone, and to refuse to be divided and conquered, to refuse to take short-term, selfish perspectives, to enlarge our moral sphere of concern as much as we can. I hope we're going to be getting into, in future episodes, the way that the money system plays a divide-and-conquer game with our ideas, focusing on how we can, quote, make money, as in get money from other people, instead of focusing on how we can make a contribution, making real items, whilst at the whole time the system is controlled by a select few who could create any amount of money out of thin air, and those are the rules. And I think it's up to us to refuse to play by them. If the rules of the game are, unless you have these magic beans, you won't eat, you won't have a place to live, and a few privileged players have the right to create any number of magic beans out of nothing, as banks do, then that is basically serfdom repackaged. Now, we're going to get into that in a later show, but reflect on this, perhaps as a parallel with what our last speaker, Michelle Alexander, is talking about racism, which, of course, was abolished by the civil rights movement, except it wasn't, except it was just repackaged, according to her analysis of the prison system. Now, I think it behoves us, of whatever racial background, I'm a human being, I don't know about you, to be interested in this, for reasons which I won't go into, but I will let another far more eloquent speaker outline as a conclusion of the show.
More African Americans are in jail, in prison, on probation, or on parole than were slaves in 1850. More black men are denied the right to vote today than in 1870. It's because they're felons. When Michelle Alexander looks at those facts, she comes to this conclusion. America's criminal justice system is the new Jim Crow. That's right, she says, the criminal justice system is a racial caste system. And she says it's not an accident. She argues that the end of legal segregation led to the racial politics of the 1980s, and she says those racial politics led to the war on drugs, which resulted in the explosion of America's prison population. Michelle Alexander is a professor at Ohio State University's Law School and the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. The Gates Public Service Law Program brought Michelle Alexander to the University of Washington on April 13, 2010.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share with you my work and my passion in life, which is working to end the history of racial caste in America. Using a term like racial caste may seem odd today, given the election of Barack Obama. Conversations and debates about race are, you know, typically dismissed as yesterday's news, not much relevant to the current era. We're frequently told by media pundits and politicians alike that we've, as a nation, have finally moved beyond race. And not just in the United States, but around the world, there is the sense that the United States has finally triumphed over race with the election of Barack Obama, and that his election represents kind of the final nail in the coffin of Jim Crow. My book is a direct challenge to that racial narrative. It's intended as a wake-up call. I argue that racial caste is not dead. It is alive and well in America. The mass incarceration of poor people of color in the United States operates like a racial caste system. The systematic targeting of people of color, often at young ages, branding them as felons, and then ushering them into a permanent second-class status, one that they occupy for life, functions now in our society much in the same way that Jim Crow once did. And, you know, I'm well aware that this kind of claim may strike some people as bordering on absurd. You know, I mentioned in the introduction to my book that I myself dismiss the idea that something akin to a racial caste system could be operating in the United States many years ago. You know, I describe in the introduction to my book that I first encountered the idea that a new racial caste system could exist in the United States when I was rushing to catch the bus. And a bright orange poster caught my eye. It was stapled to a telephone pole. And the poster kind of screamed in, large bold print, "The drug war is the new Jim Crow." And I scanned the text of the flyer for a few minutes, and I saw that a radical community group was holding a meeting in a small church a few blocks away. The church itself had seating capacity probably for no more than 50 or so people. And they were organizing to protest the new three strikes law in California, the expansion of the prison system, and police brutality. And I remember looking at the poster and thinking to myself, the criminal justice system is racist in a lot of ways, but it doesn't help to make such absurd comparisons. People just think you're crazy. And I crossed the street, ran to catch the bus, hopped on the bus on my way to my new job as director of the Racial Justice Project at the ACLU. Now, when I started working at the ACLU, I assumed that the criminal justice system had problems of racial bias, much in the same way that all institutions in our society today are infected to some degree, with conscious and unconscious racial bias. Prior to joining the ACLU, I had been working as a civil rights attorney litigating large class action employment discrimination cases against companies like Home Depot and public supermarkets in the South. And, I understood well the ways in which racial stereotyping, gender stereotyping can infect subjective decision-making of all kinds at all levels of an organization with disastrous consequences. So I figured I'm just going to shift my attention from employment discrimination to criminal justice reform and, use the same tools and strategies that I had used in the employment discrimination context to criminal justice reform and work with others to, root out racial bias wherever and wherever it might rear its ugly head in the criminal justice system. But by the time I left the ACLU, I realized that I had been wrong about the criminal justice system. It's not just another institution in our society infected with racial bias, but a different beast entirely. The activists that posted that sign on the telephone pole, they weren't crazy, nor were the smattering of lawyers and advocates around the country that were beginning to connect the dots between mass incarceration and earlier forms of racial control. So quite belatedly, really only after years of working on racial profiling litigation, learning about the struggles of people who are incarcerated and released and struggling to find jobs and employment on the outside, only after years of working on these issues and having my own moments of personal awakening did I finally come to see that mass incarceration truly is a stunningly comprehensive and well-disguised form of racial control analogous to Jim Crow. I state my basic thesis in the introduction to my book. I say what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, exclusion from jury service, are all suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. Well, here are a few of the facts that I uncovered in the course of my research and that I cite in my book. More African Americans are under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. In 2004, more African American men were disenfranchised due to felon disenfranchisement laws than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. And in some major urban areas in the United States today, if you take into account prisoners, the majority of working-age African-American men have been branded criminals and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In fact, in 2002, the Urban League released a report showing that in Chicago, the figure is nearly 80%. 80% of working-age African-American men branded criminals, have criminal records. They are permanently locked into an inferior second-class status. These men are part of a growing undercaste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race that can be discriminated against by law for the rest of their lives, much like their grandparents or great-grandparents may have been under an explicitly racial system of control. Now, I find that when I tell people that, you know, I think that mass incarceration amounts to some kind of new system of racial control, I'm kind of usually met with, you know, shock, disbelief. People say, how can you say that? You know, just look at Barack Obama, look at Oprah Winfrey, look at Colin Powell. The list goes on and on of highly visible African Americans in positions of leadership or power who have attained great wealth. And these individuals are offered as proof that we can't possibly have a caste-like system operating in the United States today. But I think it's important to keep in mind that no caste system in the United States has ever governed all African Americans. There have always been free blacks and black success stories, even during slavery and Jim Crow. During slavery, there were some black slave owners, not many, but some. And during Jim Crow, there were some black lawyers and black doctors, not many, you know, but some. You know, the extraordinary nature of individual black achievement today in formerly white domains does indicate that the old Jim Crow system is dead. But it doesn't necessarily mean the end of racial caste. You know, if history is any guide, it may have just taken a different form. Any honest observer of American racial history has to acknowledge that the rules and reasons the legal system employs to enforce status relations of any kind, well, they evolve and they change as they're challenged. You know, the first chapter of my book is devoted to, you know, describing kind of these cyclical rebirths of racial caste in America. You know, after the collapse of slavery, a convict leasing system emerged in the South to replace the institution of slavery. There's a fantastic book by Douglas Blackman called Slavery by Another Name that talks about the practice at the end of the Civil War of African-American men being rounded up en masse for minor crimes like loitering, arrested, sent to prisons, and then shipped out to plantations, leased out to plantations. And the idea was that these folks had to kind of earn their freedom, but the catch was they could never earn enough to pay back the cost of their shelter and their food to their plantation owners. And so, you know, they were in perpetual slavery, you know, many years after the supposed collapse of slavery following the Civil War. So a system like slavery emerged as a backlash to the Civil War. And of course, then there was the emergence of Jim Crow as convict leasing began to fade away. Now, most historians imagine that, you know, although Jim Crow and convict leasing systems clearly emerged as a backlash to the collapse of slavery, that no similar system has emerged following the collapse of Jim Crow. But I think if we take a closer look at the way mass incarceration actually operates in communities of color, you know, we're forced to reach a different conclusion. You know, the emergence of mass incarceration has been, you know, truly sudden and dramatic. In a period of, you know, less than 30 years, we went from having a prison population of about 300,000 to more than 2 million. Our nation's prison population quintupled, not doubled or tripled, quintupled, an exceptionally short period of time. You know, the United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of even highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, or Iran. In fact, if we as a nation were to return to the incarceration rates we had in the 1970s, you know, a time when many civil rights activists actually thought that rates of incarceration were egregiously high, but if we were just to go back to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. That's how enormous and deeply entrenched, kind of in the basic economic fabric of our society, that mass incarceration has become in an incredibly short period of time. But in my view, it's the racial dimension of mass incarceration that is the most striking feature. You know, no other country in the world imprisons such a large percentage of its racial and ethnic minorities. You know, several years ago, it was estimated that in Washington, D.C., you know, 3 out of 4 young black men and nearly all those who lived in the poorest neighborhoods could expect to serve time in prison. You know, rates of incarceration nearly as shocking can be found in other urban areas across America. Now, most people assume that this explosion in our prison system, you know, can be explained by crime rates. People say, well, yeah, of course our prison population shot through the roof because of crime. Crime went up, so prison population went up. Not so. You know, crime rates over the last 30 years have fluctuated. Risen and fallen over the last 30 years, and today are at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. You know, most sociologists now agree that rates of incarceration have moved independently of crime rates. Whether crime rates are going up or down, incarceration rates have continued to soar. So, you know, if the prison population hasn't exploded because of crime rates, well, what is it then? Well, it turns out that, you know, the activists who posted the sign on the telephone pole were right. No, the war on drugs is the single most important cause of the prison boom in the United States and the branding of millions of Americans as felons for life. About 2/3 of the increase in the federal system is due to drug convictions, and more than half of the increase in the state system is due to drug convictions. Drug convictions have increased about 1,000% since the drug war first began. And for those who might think that, you know, the target in this war has been violent offenders or drug kingpins, it's not the case. You know, in 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for simple possession. Only 1 out of 5 were for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses today have no history of violence or significant selling activity. You know, and in the 1990s, the period of the greatest expansion of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession. You know, a drug that, you know, many scientists now believe is less harmful than alcohol or tobacco, and a drug that is equally as prevalent in middle-class white communities on college campuses as it is in inner-city communities. But the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, resulting in astronomical increases in incarceration rates, particularly of black and brown men, although increasingly of women. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been black, brown. Now, the reality is that there are almost no differences in drug use or selling activity across racial groups. You know, for decades now, surveys have consistently shown and studies have consistently shown that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. Now, this defies, you know, our basic racial stereotypes about who drug dealers are. You know, when we picture a drug dealer, we typically imagine, you know, a black kid standing on a street corner somewhere, maybe with his pants hanging down. Well, drug dealing happens in the ghetto, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. You know, a kid in rural Nebraska or rural Kansas, he doesn't drive to the hood to get his marijuana or his meth or, you know, whatever. No, he gets it from a friend, classmate, coworker, somebody down the road. Now, it turns out that drug markets in the United States are relatively segregated by race and class, much like American society generally. You know, whites tend to sell to whites, blacks tend to sell to blacks, university students sell to each other. So the concentration of the drug war in poor communities of color cannot be justified by rates of drug crime, drug use, drug sales. Well, why is it being waged there? Well, the drug war from the outset had never much to do with drug crime. It was about racial politics. You know, most people think the war on drugs was launched in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities across America, or rising drug crime. Not true. The current drug war was officially announced by President Ronald Reagan in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually declining, and a couple years before crack first emerged in Los Angeles and later spread to communities of color, inner city communities of color across America. The war on drugs was motivated by racial politics. It was part of the Republican Party's kind of grand strategy, often referred to as the Southern strategy, of attempting to appeal to poor and working class white voters who were resentful of, disaffected by many of the gains of the civil rights movement, particularly busing, desegregation, and affirmative action. Now, many of these folks had good reason to feel concerned about the changes wrought by the civil rights movement. You know, it wasn't kind of rich white folks that had their worlds rocked by desegregation. You know, they were able to send their kids to private schools. No, it was primarily poor and working class white folks who were suddenly, you know, forced to compete on equal terms for scarce jobs with a group of people that they had long been taught to view as their inferiors. It was their kids who were, you know, facing potential busing orders across time. And there was anxiety and fear wrought by the social upheaval brought by the civil rights movement. Well, Republican Party strategists and pollsters found that they could appeal to those poor and working class white voters through racially coded political appeals on issues of crime and welfare. And through these racially coded political appeals, they could get, you know, white voters, particularly in the South, who had long been kind of members of the Democratic Party, to defect from the Democratic kind of New Deal coalition to the Republican Party. And so these racially coded political appeals and get tough campaigns and law and order rhetoric was part of that strategy of appealing to those voters. And when Ronald Reagan declared the war on drugs at a time when drug crime was actually declining and people weren't that much worried about drug crime, it was an effort to make good on campaign promises to get tough on a group of people that had been defined in the political rhetoric and in the media imagery as black and brown. Now, the Reagan administration got lucky And a couple years after the war was officially declared, crack hit the streets in Los Angeles and spread to inner city communities. And the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize images of crack babies, crack dealers, crack-related violence. Staff whose job it was to feed stories about these folks and find examples of crack babies, crack whores in the inner city to feed to mainstream media outlets. Their hope was that by, you know, publicizing and sensationalizing, you know, crack-related use, abuse, and violence in inner city communities, that it could boost public support for the drug war and turn the rhetorical war into a literal one. And the plan worked like a charm. Almost overnight, you know, television sets were saturated with images of black and brown drug dealers and users. In the mid-1980s and early 1990s, it was nearly impossible to turn on the evening news without seeing images of black and brown men in handcuffs being paraded off to prison for drug-related offenses or sweeps being done of housing projects in ghetto communities. It saturated the news, and it forever changed our conceptions about who drug users and dealers are. And it's because of that media campaign conducted by the Republican administrations and the media imagery that followed that in 1995, a national survey was conducted asking people, close your eyes for a minute and imagine, you know, a drug criminal. 95% of the respondents pictured someone who was African American. Only 5%. You know, pictured anyone of any other race. So it's no surprise that in that political environment that the war would be waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. And Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove that they could be even tougher on them, tougher on, you know, the racially defined others in the media imagery and in the news. And President Clinton outdid Ronald Reagan. He escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessor had even imagined possible. The greatest increase in incarceration rates in, you know, United States history happened during the Clinton administration, not during the Reagan administration, because Clinton was so desperate to appeal to and try to woo that same block of voters that had proved so responsive to the racially charged get tough rhetoric on crime and welfare. And that's why Clinton pledged to end welfare as we know it and escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican counterparts had dreamed possible. So here we are as a result, you know, years after all the media fanfare and the get tough rhetoric, and we have people of all colors, serving lengthy sentences unheard of in other Western democracies for often relatively minor, nonviolent, drug-related offenses. You know, if you go to, you know, places in Europe and tell people that here in the United States there are people doing life sentences for marijuana possession, they'll just look at you like you're crazy. It's absolutely unheard of. You know, here in the United States, our Supreme Court upheld life imprisonment for a first-time drug offense. Absolutely unheard of, really, you know, in any other democracy in the world. And the fact that those who are trapped in the new undercast are not only black and brown, but are also white, is a reflection of a drug war and a get-tough movement that has spiraled out of control and caused harm to people of all colors. You know, Jim Crow, of course, was a system of rules, laws, policies, and customs that, you know, served to lock African Americans in a permanent second-class status for life. Well, consider whether some of the rules and laws that apply to those labeled felons, and kind of ask yourself whether they remind you of a bygone era. first and most obviously is denial of the right to vote. You know, I'm thrilled that here in Washington State, you know, that Washington State has now become one of the few states where prisoners, as well as those who have been branded felons, have the right to vote as a result of, you know, legislative action and the decision, hopefully you're all familiar with, by the Ninth Circuit, ruling that the denial of the right to vote to people in prison is a violation of the Voting Rights Act, because the criminal justice system, particularly in drug law enforcement in Washington State, is so rife with racial bias. And that the racial disparities can't be explained on race-neutral terms. In fact, state made no attempt to explain them in race-neutral terms, that the denial of the right to vote to prisoners violates the Voting Rights Act. Well, most other states in the United States, that's not the case. And the denial of the right to vote is routine in most states in the United States to people who are prisoners, and then even once you've been released from prison, you can be denied the right to vote for a period of years or for your entire life. Employment discrimination against those branded felons is perfectly legal. Job applications ranging from Burger King clerk to accountant all got that box on the employment application that you have to check if you've ever been convicted of a felony. You know, studies indicate that 70% of employers won't even consider hiring someone who's been convicted of a drug felony. You know, never mind that most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime, but if you've been branded a felon, if you've been caught with drugs, well, then the odds of you getting employment again are extremely slim if you check that box. Housing discrimination. Housing discrimination is perfectly legal. During the Jim Crow era, of course, that was the era of racially restrictive covenants. But today, housing discrimination is perfectly legal. Public housing projects, as well as private landlords, are not only authorized to discriminate, but in federal public housing, they're required to discriminate. Public housing is off limits to you for a minimum of 5 years once you've been released from prison. So imagine, here you are, released from prison, no money, no job. Public housing is off limits to you. Many homeless shelters today screen for criminal convictions. Where are folks, the 600,000 people released from prison every year, where are these folks expected to go? Many folks who are released from prison return to the communities from which they came, ghetto communities, and their relatives risk eviction if they allow you to stay with them. So no job, nowhere to sleep. What are you expected to do? Well, in most states, you're expected to pay thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs. Some states, you're expected to pay back the cost of your imprisonment. Paying back these fees, fines, and court costs are often a condition of your parole. And in fact, in many states, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished to pay back the cost of your imprisonment, accumulated child support, fees, fines, court costs. What do we expect these folks to do? Even if you're one of the lucky few who managed to land a job after checking the box, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished. And you're not even eligible for food stamps. By federal law, thanks to President Clinton, even food stamps are off limits to people who've been branded drug felons. Pregnant women, people with HIV, AIDS, you're hungry, sick, can't even get food stamps. Now, what is the system designed to do? You know, from all appearances, it appears designed to send people right back to prison, which is what happens about 70% of the time. 70% of people released from prison return within 3 years. And the majority of those who return do so in a matter of months because the legal hurdles and the barriers to just surviving and making it in the mainstream society and the legal economy are so great. So then we have three strikes laws. You know, here in Washington State, there's someone serving, you know, a life sentence, a three-strike sentence for stealing $50 worth of groceries as their third strike. You know, people are then punished for the rest of their lives, locked up in the keys, thrown away, for struggling to survive once being branded a felon. Now, of course, there's also other political forms of discrimination analogous to Jim Crow, like exclusion from jury service. You know, one hallmark of the Jim Crow era was the systematic exclusion of African Americans from juries and kind of the all-white juries, particularly in the South. Well, in many areas, all-white juries have been making a roaring comeback. You know why? Because those branded felons are deemed automatically ineligible for jury service. And then get this, even if you haven't been branded a felon, if you've ever had a negative experience with law enforcement, well then, you know, that can disqualify you for cause from a jury in a criminal case because you're perceived to have experiences with law enforcement that would make it difficult, if not impossible, for you to be impartial in a criminal case. So in many areas, you know, the all-white jury and the systematic exclusion of African Americans from jury service has come roaring back because of mass incarceration and the branding of millions of people as felons, frequently for nonviolent and drug-related offenses. But of all of the kind of formal political forms of discrimination and exclusion that are in place today for those branded felons, you know, in my experience, those who've been branded felons will often say that these legal rules, these legal forms of discrimination are not the worst of it. That the worst is actually the stigma and shame that you bear as being viewed as a criminal, being branded a felon. It's not just the denial of the job, but the look that flashes across the employer's face when he sees that box has been checked. You know, the shame and the stigma associated with criminality in the era of mass incarceration has real parallels to the shame and stigma of race in the Jim Crow era. During Jim Crow, you know, light-skinned blacks would often try to pass as white to avoid the shame and stigma associated with race. Well, today, you know, those branded felons often lie not just to employers and, you know, to housing officials, but also to their friends, family, and loved ones, trying to hide their criminal status or that of their family members due to shame. You know, there's a fascinating study that was done in Washington, D.C., of an area, you know, hard hit by mass incarceration, a neighborhood where, you know, every house or every other apartment had someone who, you know, had either been recently released from prison or had a family member behind bars. And these were neighborhoods where you would think that mass incarceration was just, you know, completely normalized. But instead, the ethnographers found that not a single person in this study had fully come out to their friends, neighbors, loved ones about their own criminal history or criminal status or that of their loved ones. That there was still such shame and stigma associated with it that people felt it'd be better not to mention it, to keep quiet. So there's an eerie silence that has fallen over even the communities hardest hit by mass incarceration. You know, one rooted in shame, you know, for some, and for others of us, in denial. Now, we are in deep denial as a nation about the existence of caste in America and the experience of millions of people cycling in and out of the criminal justice system today. Now, you know, a big part of this denial is rooted in the fact that prisoners are literally erased from poverty statistics and unemployment statistics. You know, prisoners are just not even counted. In fact, if you read unemployment statistics for African Americans, you read, you know, unemployment for African Americans is 15% or, you know, whatever the current number is. Well, you can actually add 15, 20, up to 23 percentage points to that number to account for all of the African Americans behind bars. So this illusion of great progress has been engineered in part by the removal of millions of people from our poverty rolls, from our unemployment statistics through mass incarceration. You know, an affirmative action you know, the election of Barack Obama has helped to create kind of a happy face on America's racial reality. But if you take a close look at the data and include prisoners within it, you see that African Americans as a group are actually not better off than they were in 1968 when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated and uprisings swept inner city communities across America. We are today much in the same place that we were when Martin Luther King Jr. said, we need to build a poor people's movement in the United States and join, you know, poor folks of all colors in a struggle for basic human rights. And that, I believe, is the work that is left unfinished and that we must go back to do, not just to end mass incarceration, but to do the healing work and the movement building work that is necessary to end the history of racial caste in America and build a society that genuinely recognizes and honors the human rights of all. The comment, for those of you who may not have been able to hear, was that black and brown women, African American and Latina, are affected now as much as men of color by the war on drugs and mass incarceration, and that this Get Tough movement has resulted in younger and younger people being, you know, charged as adults and, you know, labeled felons at earlier and earlier ages as well. And, you know, both of those points are very well taken. In fact, women are the fastest growing sector of the prison population today, African-American women and Latinas. And their incarceration, you know, I fear will have even more drastic consequences for community than the incarceration of black and brown men. Why? Well, because, you know, these communities are already so fragile because of the absence of so many black men. And to begin removing the women and the mothers of the children, those who have, you know, historically been the primary caretakers, is to relegate generations of children to the foster care system. And the data of, you know, what happens to kids once they're released from foster care is, you know, just tragic and really sobering. I mean, at least in California, you know, the majority of kids, you know, who are released from foster care at the age of 18 wind up in prison in less than 3 years. So really, you're sentencing those children when you incarcerate their mothers. You are sentencing those children to a lifetime of institutionalization. So I am deeply concerned about the trend of targeting women for relatively minor drug offenses and the consequences that has for families. And I want to share with you just one story. There's a woman named Susan Burton who I met, you know, just a few months ago, who now runs a number of homes for women recently released from prison. Now, Susan, many years ago, was standing in her front yard when she witnessed a police officer killing her son, ran him over with a police car. The car was barreling down her street, and her son was 5-year-old son, was run over. Now, she spiraled into deep depression and grief. If she had been wealthy, she might have been able to get legal drugs prescribed to her to help her cope, right? She would have been able to get a psychiatrist. She would have had good health care coverage, get a psychiatrist, give her good legal drugs. Well, that didn't happen. She didn't have that. And she became addicted to illegal drugs. And as a result, she cycled in and out of prison 6 times. Finally, she was able to get into a drug treatment program in Santa Monica, got clean, and committed herself to ensuring that no other woman would ever have to go through what she suffered as a result. And so she one morning woke up and went down to Skid Row, which is where they let prisoners off the prison bus. You're left off, you know, get off the bus just carrying your cardboard box with your belongings, get off the bus with nowhere to go, often little money. She would meet women at the bus and say, just come home with me, you know, sleep in my dining room or sleep on my couch and have a safe place. And she began doing that, and now she's running five houses for women, often with children. And I toured these houses, and, you know, there's bunk beds and, you know, kids' toys scattered around, and here are these women struggling to make it on the outside for their families and to hold their families together. And if they slip up, tiniest slip up, they can find themselves right back in prison again, and their hopes of being able to raise their children are likely gone forever. And as for younger people being, you know, branded felons and treated as adults, you're absolutely right that the Get Tough movement, the law and order kind of frenzy that overtook the United States, has resulted not only in the drug war, but three strikes laws and the treating of youth as adults. It's been this punitive impulse rather than a compassionate one. And, you know, I would argue that this punitive impulse is largely due to the fact that when we think about criminals, we tend to think about folks of color. And it is our failure as a nation to have the same care, compassion, and concern for kids in the ghetto as, you know, you might for white suburban kids that has resulted in these incredibly harsh approaches to dealing with problems of youth crime. And, you know, youth commit crimes. That's part of being young in America to a large extent. I think there's very few folks in this room who did not violate the law in some way when they were young, drinking underage, experimenting with drugs, speeding on the freeway. You know, we are all criminals. But only some of us get branded, and only some of us get relegated to a permanent second-class status for life. And in America, it's primarily youth of color that suffer that fate.
I don't know good horse as we trot in this dark here. Robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it.
For those who say to me, stick to civil rights, I have another answer. That is that I've fought too long and too hard now against segregated public accommodation to end up segregating my moral concerns. I'm not going to do that. Others can do what they want to do. That's their business. Other civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration. That's their business. But I'm afraid that I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.